Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Releasing medical records is not a state's rights issue, it's a personal rights issue.
Alaska's Attorney General signs a letter supporting access to medical information about abortions in other states. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 19th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, summer culture camp students at Akyachuk get fishing lessons on the Kuskokwim River.
That red one right there in front of us
keeps moving.
Right there! 3 more!
If I were a fish, I would have just jumped over it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
And by
Alaska Air Cargo, serving the commerce and business needs of 20 Alaska communities, from Adak to Barrow to Ketchikan. More information at alaskacargo.com.
Alaska Attorney General Treg Taylor signed a letter last month supporting states' rights to access medical information about abortion and gender-affirming care. The letter was addressed to the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services and was signed by 18 other state attorneys general. It's a response to the Biden administration's proposed protections of patient privacy when crossing state lines for medical care. The letter says the protections would obstruct states' ability to enforce their laws on abortion, and it airs concerns that the proposed protections might advance, quote, radical transgender policy goals if applied to gender-affirming care. Rose O'Hara Jolly is the Alaska State Director for Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates. They say the Attorney General's job is to protect all of Alaskans' rights, including the right to abortion.
Releasing medical records is not a state's rights issue, it's a personal rights issue, and we have the right to speak with our medical professionals without government interference.
Alaskans' rights to abortion are protected in the state constitution. In an email, Taylor acknowledged this. He said the letter is about preserving states' rights in the face of federal overreach. O'Hara Jolly says Planned Parenthood has already gotten many calls and emails from Alaskans worried that their rights have changed. They worry the letter will mean people don't feel comfortable being open with their medical care providers.
Our biggest concern is that now people will be afraid to talk to doctors and medical professionals or will think that they are unable to get care. What he's done has put the health and safety of all Alaskans in jeopardy.
In his email, Attorney General Taylor said the state will not seek out medical information from other states. And he said Alaska is not planning to provide medical information to other states, even if medical privacy laws change. Alaska's predator control programs, aimed at boosting moose, caribou, and deer populations for hunters, do not work, according to research by 2 retired state fish and game biologists and a University of Alaska Fairbanks professor. The study they're presenting at the International Mammalogical Congress in Anchorage tomorrow, published in the scientific journal Diversity, says an analysis of 1 South Central Alaska game unit found no increase in moose harvests in the years following predator control work there. The State Division of Wildlife Conservation disputes that, saying not enough time had passed between the predator control work and the analysis of moose harvests to expect higher numbers of moose. But the study's lead author, Sterling Miller, spent 2 decades at the Division of Wildlife Conservation and says the state's predator control program is driven by politics and not science.
I think the Fish and Game Department and the Division of Wildlife Conservation has not done adequate analysis and in some cases has even misled the Alaska public about whether or not these programs are accomplishing their objectives. So we decided to look at 1 study area, which is an area where I worked for 20 years, where predator management on bears has been going on effectively since 1980, and it's been increasing throughout that time. And wolf management has been also very aggressive and really accelerated in 2005. So we decided to look and see whether or not harvest of moose has increased in this area. So that's called a case history analysis.
I mean, it seems like a lot of number crunching. How do you do the work of doing an analysis like that?
Well, one of the problems with the way intensive management has been conducted in Alaska is that they don't set it up with an experimental design where it can be readily analyzed. They just kind of back into these things. The Board of Game just decides that they would like to be able to harvest more moose in some area or caribou. And then so they just start liberalizing regulations and then sometimes going to active predator control, which involves shooting predators from aircraft. So what we had to do was try to patch it together from existing data, which is basically just the harvest data is all we had. We looked at various time lags between predator harvest in a year, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, to the end of the data time series to see whether or not there were correlations between the number of predators killed for each of the three predator species and numbers of moose subsequently harvested. And we were unable to see any correlation with any time lag.
I'm no, you know, biologist myself, but I feel like it's fairly well understood that predators like wolves and bears definitely prey on moose calves. I think it's even maybe noted in that paper. So how is it possible that killing those predators in a predator control program would not result in more moose?
That is an excellent question, Casey. And in fact, there's a lot of people that are very confused on exactly that point. And, you know, I actually, in 1979, a colleague named Warren Bowder and I in Unit 13 did an experiment in which we moved 49 grizzly bears out of the headwaters of the Susitna River, just south of the Alaska Range. And then we looked to see whether or not there was any response in moose calf survivorship. And in fact, there was a response. You know, the calves are born in the spring, and that very fall, there was an increase in calf-cow ratios. But the real question is, do those calves survive into subsequent years and become adults? Or are they subject to what's called compensatory mortality, which means that they die of something else? And in fact, in very many cases, particularly when a population of moose, for example, is near carrying capacity, the mortality to the calves is not additive. That means if you can kill all the predators and the calves would still die of something else because predation is not the limiting factor.
Well, I have to ask, I mean, this has been a controversial program, predator control in Alaska for a long time. And I wonder, how do you think that the state is going to receive this research that says that it's not working?
Well, the state is pushing back. You know, there are some good biologists in the state. And there, you know, are some analyses that have been done, which I believe are being done in the wrong way, because they compare between areas rather than doing within an area. But there are a lot of things that affect calf survivorship and densities of moose other than predation. And so it's very difficult to compare between areas. The thing that most likely is a big difference between areas is habitat conditions. And habitat conditions can vary dramatically. For moose, for example, the big variable that affects habitat conditions are fires. And if you have fires, it sets back the vegetation so that there's an earlier successional stage, you know, more willows and less spruce trees, and that's good for moose. But it's very difficult to do a controlled burn in Unit 13. It's very hard to get permission from the federal agencies, particularly the BLM. And there's a lot of pushback from people who have cabins and things in the area. The Fish and Game Department has to manage any time where there's more demand for ungulates than is supply, they have to do intensive management. And really, the only kind of intensive management that can be done or has been done is predator control, because the other strings on what's limiting, like habitat conditions, are really not strings you can pull very effectively or inexpensively.
That was retired Alaska Department of Fish and Game biologist Sterling Miller, the co-author of a study that says the state's predator control program doesn't work. Find that at mdpi.com/journal/diversity. In response, the acting director of the Division of Wildlife Conservation, Ryan Scott, says the division, quote, respectfully disagrees with Miller and his colleagues. Scott says the study's time period was too short and that while there are factors other than predators to consider, predator control is a tool the division uses to turn around declining prey populations. Scott adds that, quote, people have very strong feelings about intensive management and the negative aspect. There's a lot of Alaskans that feel positively about it, and it impacts Alaskans, end quote. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, remembering world-renowned whale biologist Craig George.
We know he's given back so much, taken our traditional knowledge and science to the world stage and defended it many times.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in. There are many ways to support your local public media station. Donate now and arrange to make a planned gift as a bequest. Your legacy will stretch from today to many tomorrows.
A 15-year-old died in Kenai Fjords National Park Monday afternoon while hiking the Harding Icefield Trail, according to park officials. A statement from the national park says the young hiker needed emergency medical services and CPR about 3.7 miles into the trail. It says bystanders helped to provide CPR and paramedics from a LifeMed helicopter attempted to resuscitate the hiker, but were unsuccessful, and he died on the trail of cardiac arrest. According to the park, agencies including Alaska State Troopers, Alaska Wildlife Troopers, the Bear Creek Fire Department, Seward Volunteer Ambulance Corps, and LifeMed Alaska all responded. The statement does not say why the hiker collapsed or needed CPR. Troopers say the body was transported to Soldotna, then released to the state medical examiner's office, who will determine the cause and manner of death. According to reporting from the Detroit News in Michigan, the hiker who died was from Farmington Hills, a suburb of Detroit. The story identifies him as 16-year-old Simon Merks, a participant in a month-and-a-half-long summer camping trip in Alaska for Jewish families and children. It says the camp's president and director sent a letter to parents informing them that Merks collapsed and died during a hike. The Detroit News reports that the other campers on the trip are being housed at a Jewish center in Anchorage and that additional counselors are flying out from Michigan to support the students. In the mid-80s, three villages, Akiachuk, Akiak, and Tuluksak, broke away from the Lower Kuskokwim School District and formed the Ubiut School District. The mission was a different vision of education, one that more fully embraced traditional Native knowledge. And as KYUK's Evan Erickson reports, they've successfully fought for a new calendar this year, too, one that gives students the freedom to participate in seasonal subsistence harvests.
It's late June in Akiachuk, and the school is in its first week of a summer culture camp. Teachers and elders meet students at a large cutting table near the teacher housing. Literacy coach Evelyn Esmalka wields a large ulu as she explains the differences between chum, chinook, and sockeye salmon to the small group of children. After this lesson, the kids are going fishing for salmon on the nearby Kuskokwim River.
This will be for the winter supply of fish supplement, the lunch program.
Woody Woodgate, the school district's federal programs director, says staff favor indigenous foods in the district's cafeterias.
And not really taking away anything from the USDA and the school lunch program, but you know, most of that stuff that's on those menus are designed for know, people in big cities or lower 48. And a lot of it just goes into the trash can because if kids don't want to eat the food. So if we can supplement using fish and moose, and especially fish and moose that the kids catch.
In the mid-80s, three villages, Akiachuk, Akiak, and Tuluksak, broke away from the Lower Kuskokwim School District and formed the Ubiit School District. The mission was a different vision of education, one that more fully embraced traditional Native knowledge. In the nearly 40 years since the Ubiit School District was formed, nothing has come easy. The district has faced chronic issues with funding, teacher turnover, low attendance, and low test scores, often leading to friction with the state education department. But they're working to change that. This year was the district's first under the new subsistence calendar. School leaders spent much of 2022 working to get it approved by the state. Now, students begin the school year about a month later than other districts in the state, and they finish roughly a month earlier. They make up the difference with an extra half hour of instruction each day. This allows them to take part in the fall moose hunt and the spring migratory bird harvest. The strategy is to pass along traditional knowledge that cannot be gained in the classroom, but it is also aimed at addressing poor attendance issues during these seasonal harvests. With the exception of sockeye, the salmon runs on the Kuskokwim River are crashing, and today is one of the limited opportunities to fish for them. But time is ticking away on the 12-hour salmon fishing opener, so the order of the day is making sure that kids who aren't already on the river get a chance to take part in the harvest.
The older kids are out already fishing with their families, so these are, let's see, second grade, third grader, and three fourth graders, so getting them out here.
That's Baron Sample, now in his third year as principal at the Akiachuk School.
Now for some of them, this has been the first time they're actually out here on the river doing this.
The 24-foot boat is one of three owned by the school district. After a 150-foot gill net is unfurled, the boat drifts slowly down the river. The children intently watch a line of buoys for signs of life.
That one, red one right there in front of us,
it keeps moving.
Right there! Three moved!
We're going to have quite a story to tell when I go home.
Three. Yep. If I were a fish, I would have just jumped over it.
While the first drift only yields two fish, the second brings in around a dozen, a mixture of reds, kings, and chums.
That's a king salmon!
Wow!
Of course it's dying.
I want to fish again.
Me too.
I just want to fish again.
This is actually a good spot to fish.
As the boat drifted down the river, Sample talked about the journey that led him to Alaska from Maryland back in 2008 to accept a job as a teacher in a village with fewer than 500 residents. Sample is an exception to the constant turnover that plagues the state.
I mean, that was actually one of my big reasons to move into becoming administrator here. Was that over the years I've seen a principal do 1 year, 1 year, 2 years, and they're gone. So, I mean, having the stability, the institutional memory, our kids deserve that, and I felt that's really the driving focus for me being here.
The kids have been out on the river for a couple hours, and it's time to head in.
I want to fish again so bad.
With only a matter of hours before the Kuskokwim River again closes to salmon fishing, the village of Akiachuk feels like a ghost town. But along the river, the fish camps are buzzing with activity as families process the day's harvest in a way that has changed little over the centuries. In Akiachuk, I'm Evan Erickson.
The Ok Rock Indigenous Music Festival returns to Juneau this fall. Billed as the only Indigenous music festival in the country, it will bring performers from Alaska and around the world to the newly renovated Centennial Hall the third week of September. Kachung Blanchette, a member of the band Bumyua, is one of the organizers. He was inspired to create Ok Rock after performing at Indigenous music festivals in places like Canada and Europe.
So there's places that have them, and we've performed at those. And to see the pride and the joy and connection that happens in those places over the years, it was like, God, we have to have one.
Blanchette says the goal is to celebrate Indigenous music by exposing it to a larger audience while also building relationships.
It's not just about music. We're actually going to have time for us to really get a chance to really get to know each other. We're going to create a space that has this opportunity to have these moments of connection with people from all over the world.
This year's lineup includes international performers, including First Nations hip-hop groups Snotty Nose Rez Kids and The Hallucination, and Rob Ruha from New Zealand. It also includes NPR Tiny Desk contest winner Quinn Christofferson from Anchorage and Juno's Air Jazz.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from oversized equipment to small packages for commercial or residential. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
A section of the Chulitna River where biologist John Craig George of Utqiagvik was killed in a rafting accident earlier this month is a popular float trip accessed off the park's highway and not normally that difficult. But longtime paddler John Schauer of Fairbanks says conditions around the time of the July 5th accident were more dangerous. Schauer says he's paddled the East Fork several times, most recently in late June.
There were definitely a lot of fresh trees in the river.
Schauer says, according to a member of George's group who's paddled the section of the Chulitna more than a dozen times, their two rafts rounded a blind corner just past Antimony Creek and encountered a log jam.
Craig was swept out of his raft by a log, and then as he was trying to re-enter the boat stuck onto a log jam, and that's where they lost sight of him there in that log jam.
A search was launched immediately, but it wasn't until July 16th that George's body was recovered, about 7.5 miles downstream of where the accident occurred. Schauer stresses that everyone in the 5-person group was wearing a life jacket, had rescue gear, and a lot of experience.
Sometimes it seems like the river doesn't care how good you are. You know, you get in the wrong spot and wrong time, wrong day. Something you've run a lot of times, all of a sudden it's got a new hazard, or you've just misjudged, you know, where you are on that day.
Schauer emphasizes that things can happen fast and underscores the power of swift moving water.
When you're trying to maneuver a boat, you have to either be going slower than the current or faster than the current to move against the current. That force is pretty amazing.
Schauer says he had planned to paddle the East Fork of the Chulitna with his son and grandkids later this summer, but out of respect for George and what happened, they've decided to do a different river trip. And as the shock of the rafting accident that took Craig George's life begins to fade, attentions turn from how he died to how this world-renowned Arctic whale biologist lived. When it came to research, George was something of a Renaissance man who integrated knowledge from different disciplines. He was also an honorary whaling captain, a dog musher who once climbed Denali, and a beloved member of the North Slope community of Utqiagvik, known as Barrow when he first moved there in 1977. And as KNBA's Rhonda McBride found out, he made a lot of friends with his music.
Here we go. Keep on whaling.
Among the many tributes to Craig George on Facebook, you'll find different recordings of him singing this song,
keep on whaling,
which he wrote to celebrate whaling, sung at ceremonies to bless the coming harvest, at feasts and other events, and often you can hear people singing in the background.
Keep on whaling and paddle that ooh-yeah.
For Craig George, bowhead whales were more than about research.
It's hard to measure the complete impact that Craig had on our lives.
Richard Glenn, an Inupiaq whaler and longtime friend, says he admired George's holistic approach to science, that he learned about seals, birds, everything connected to the world of the whale, including people.
I think the world has yet to realize, after a career of 50 years almost, what we feel.
George was part of a group of scientists who challenged the status quo and went on to prove that native whalers had a better understanding of how to accurately track the whale population than Western science.
When the world might have been focused against them, these gentlemen spent their careers corroborating traditional knowledge about the movement of animals, about the population, and they backed their work up with real science and world-class science.
In a 2017 University of Alaska Fairbanks oral history project, George explained the key to his success.
Light went off in my head, especially when I was trying to set up ice camps and figure out how to properly estimate bowhead abundance. It's like, wow, local people are light years ahead of us.
And he found a dedicated group of elders, mostly in their 70s, to help.
I would go over with maps and questions, and they would very patiently, remarkably patiently, kind of walk me through some of the basics.
And Sea Ice 101 was one of the most important courses his mentors taught.
You can't teach physics to people that don't know math. And it was kind of true here. You couldn't teach bowheads to people who didn't know the ice and the environment and all this. So it was a really exciting period of learning.
And the nuclear will rule the sea. And the nuclear will still be wailing in the next century.
George would often say he received more from the Inupiat than he could ever possibly give back.
And yet we know he's given back so much, taken our traditional knowledge and science to the world stage and defended it many times successfully. For that reason alone, we owe him a lot of gratitude.
Richard Glenn says what impressed the Inupiat the most was that Craig George was a boots-on-the-ground kind of scientist.
Every time a whale is caught, Craig is there. He's out there among the whaling captains, so he works as hard as anybody and harder than many. Takes a lot of work just to show up.
Glenn says even at the age of 70, George didn't slow down, that his decades of dogged record-keeping are an important legacy, which now and into the future will help North Slope whalers navigate climate change and, yes, keep on whaling.
Keep on whaling. Let that big old whale come to you.
In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Rachel Cassandra, Adeline Baxter and Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, Riley Board in Kenai, Evan Erickson in Akyachuk, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Air Cargo, providing Gold Streak Express shipping for urgent deliveries throughout Alaska, with connections to more than 100 destinations in the lower 48 and Hawaii. More at alaskacargo.com.
Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.